This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Few things can bring anxiety like a sudden loss of income. The pandemic has really highlighted just how many people live on that edge. And by the way, a lot more people live paycheck to paycheck than you might think. It's not a term that's simply reserved for lower income people. And on the flip side, some lower income people might be more financially secure than most of us. It's all about management. Today, we revisit a conversation about personal finance through the lens of the pandemic with personal finance guru and fellow Hoosier Peter Dunn, better known as Pete the Planner.
Hey, Matt, it's good to be with you. Unfortunately, it's the circumstances that I'm not caring for.
Yeah, me either. I don't think anyone has. And Pete, by the way, also hosts a weekly podcast called The Pete the Planner Show. So if you like this subject, you can find that at PeteThePlanner.com or wherever you get podcasts. And he's actually joining us from his podcast studio. So let's get right into it. I have a few scenarios that I'm going to throw at you this hour that we can play with. But you're the one who does this, you know, who hears about these situations people find themselves in. What is a common personal finance scenario you've heard since the onset of the pandemic?
I think it revolves around this idea that people with higher incomes, people that have higher levels of education, are as vulnerable as people who have lower incomes. And, you know, this has been a topic for the last three decades or so that's wildly uncomfortable. It's why you don't talk about personal finance and your income with your friends and neighbors and family, because there's a lot of preconceived notion about income and stability. And I can tell you every personal finance statistic that's out there points to the fact that, you know, unless you're making deep into the six figures, you have a chance to struggle based on the decisions you make on a regular basis. And that's what we're seeing now. This nightmare scenario is playing out at nearly every income level right now.
What's the simplest reason that higher income people can have the same problems? Like what are the mistakes that people keep making?
I think the best way to think about it is you're going to buy your house. And so you go online to a mortgage calculator at a lending institution and you click on the how much house can I afford calculator. And so you're not making the decision based on what you need. You're making the decision based on what you can get away with. And I don't say that in an accusatory tone. I've been there too. I've made that mistake and I've fought back from it. And there's also this idea that our incomes always go up and that, you know, if I buy more than I can afford, whether it's a house or a car or, you know, violin lessons for my kid, I will grow into the ability to afford that. So even people's own faith and their ability to continue to succeed is knocking them over the head right now.
Well, so what can people do about that? I mean, is it just simply a question of living within your means, or is it more complex than that?
I think that's a great start. I think it's important we acknowledge for the rest of our time together here today, Matt, that there are currently three groups of people in America, and just three. There are people who have already been greatly financially impacted by the shutdown. Okay, so we just call those people in group one. Already greatly affected. That can mean a job loss, hours cut, so on and so forth. Group two are people who have not been economically affected yet, but they don't have a lot of stability. They don't have an emergency fund, which 3 months is a great start for that, 3 months expenses. And then there's group three. Those are people that have not been economically impacted, are unlikely to be economically impacted, and have a full emergency fund. So as we sit here and chat with each other today, I'll tell you, most Americans are in group one and group two. Very few people are sitting pretty right now. And so therefore, anything I tell you could sound like I told you so, but I don't want it to be, because we have to retroactively look at the decisions we've made in order to rebuild with stability in mind.
All right. So when this first started to reveal itself, this pandemic, as something that would have a huge impact on the economy, what did you think? Was it like, gulp, here it comes?
Yeah, it was, Matt, because I started thinking about just a strip mall, you know, near where I live. And I started thinking, okay, the restaurant's closed. So that means the vacuum cleaner shop is not going to get any business, which means the UPS store. And you start going down it. Then you start going up and down the supply chains. Then you think about a city like Indianapolis, which so much of the economic development comes from conventions and visitors. And then you start doing that math and the hospitality industry starts to fall apart. And by the way, if you're hearing this and this is no longer shocking, this is our reality. So I know I'm not upsetting anyone because we were upset about this 2 months ago. We're looking to rebuild. But Matt, that's what bothers me about this, is that the more creative you get about the impact of this, not only on your community, but your own life, the scarier it gets. And that is actually my concern right now. If you ask me, my biggest concern about people's personal finances is they're not being creative enough, as my colleague Lisa likes to say, about how this crisis might impact them 2, 3, 4 months down the road.
When you say creative, what do you mean by that? Are you talking about formulating scenarios in your brain to kind of help with preparation? What do you mean?
Yeah, that's a great start. And it's also, it's okay, our biggest client just laid off, and this is a hypothetical, this is not me speaking, but so sure. You think about the company you work for. Your biggest client just laid off 10,000 people. What does that mean on their impact to pay their invoices? Or what does it mean if your primary vendor went out of business? And you start to look at your job a little differently. You say, okay, well, I'm a corporate attorney. Well, maybe there's a spending freeze. And even though it's prudent to hire someone to look at your legal work and your contract work, maybe they're not making that expenditure in an effort to save jobs right now. So again, this is not to spook people, but I think people are looking at their jobs, how long they've been there, their income levels. And I hate to say this, but I feel like they're taking false comfort in their past stability as opposed to how I think this thing's really going to go.
Because the lesson of this is that it can happen at any time, and it can happen at any level of severity to as many people as it possibly can. Is that right? I mean, is that how you've kind of seen this happen? And that's a tough lesson for people.
Well, we always talk about what is doomsday. Oh, why do you need an emergency fund? Why do you actually use all of these skills and processes to prepare for this moment? And you never know what it's going to be. You know, you think back to September 11th, you always had this threat of catastrophe, but you didn't know what it was until it was, right? You remember that feeling. It's like, this was always a possibility. I didn't know what it was going to look like. I think that's the same feeling now, is it's always a possibility that you can go back to zero. You look at some of these tried and true companies that will go bankrupt, you know, publicly traded companies that weren't necessarily on the edge, but now what's the future hold for them? The airlines. And so this is why financial planning has a place. It's not popular for that very same reason. You have to imagine terrible scenarios. You have to delay gratification to fund those scenarios. And to be proven right, something awful has to happen. Mm. And that's not a popular feeling or sentiment or idea for anybody.
Have there been personal finance issues that have come out of this that surprised you? I mean, scenarios that you'd maybe never seen before or hadn't anticipated that something like this, a pandemic, would bring up?
I think some industries are really exposed. Mm. I think coming out of 2009, while people were trying to recreate and find their way in the new economy post-recession, I feel like that's what formed the gig economy. I feel like you had a lot of people who wanted to contribute a lot, and so they hustled. You know, that's the old term for it. We hustle, and you got a gig, and you drive people here, and you pick up their food and take them there, and you work freelance here. And I feel like, unknowingly, the people that chose to hustle, work 3, 4 jobs and create beautiful lifestyles and income, once again, they're susceptible to the most risk. And you can see that in the fact that the unemployment system was never created to support those people in a situation like this. You've got states all over our country that still haven't paid unemployment benefits to people within the gig economy. So that surprises me because I just didn't expect it. But had I really thought about it, it kind of does make a lot of sense.
Do you think that there are too many, along those lines, do you think that there are too many traditionalists in charge of things, you know, who aren't thinking about things like the gig economy? And when the stimulus came down and the gig economy was essentially at the start left out, did that surprise you at all? Or did you just see that as, oh, well, yeah, they don't get it?
You know, I've extended more grace to the people making these decisions than I normally would. I'm not an anti-government or leadership person by any stretch of the imagination. But I have to say, they're trying to, you know, pump money into as many places as they know how. I don't think they're negatively discriminating against anyone. I think, to your point, though, they didn't know what they didn't know, and they didn't know that the world has changed. People make their money differently, and people aren't as prepared as the government thinks they are. And so that, you know, that bothers me. Even as we talk about what's next in terms of stimulus, I don't have a tremendous amount of confidence that there's going to be a lot more stimulus. I've talked myself out of that idea. I am to the point where they're trying to time this whole thing up with the economy opening again and hoping they don't have to throw any money at all at this anymore.
But do you think, though, that the government has a place in people's, in educating people about personal finance? I mean, obviously they have a place to throw things like stimulus money at us and things like that. But do you think that there is a government solution for how, you know, how people might be educated about this moving forward?
Well, I don't know what that would look like other than to say you've got some, you know, places of leadership and government doing those sorts of things. Take the Indiana Secretary of State's office. They've got one of the most robust financial literacy and fraud prevention programs in the country, hands down. They've got one of the best programs. How many people are exposed to it? A lot of high school kids, a lot of community organizations. But I don't know, you know, do you regulate financial literacy? Do you regulate financial preparedness? I don't think you can. I mean, it's a cool idea. I don't know if you can mandate that.
We are talking to Pete the Planner, Peter Dunn, fellow Hoosier, about the lessons, the money lessons of the COVID-19 pandemic. And when we come back, we will have a few scenarios for Pete the Planner, maybe one that's close to your life. What can we learn from this pandemic about how to manage our bank accounts? I'm Matt Pelser. We are back with him in 90 seconds. This is All In. All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Today we're spending the hour with Peter Dunn, better known as personal finance expert Pete the Planner, and we're talking about what the pandemic has taught us about being prepared for financial emergencies. So let's start simple. Here's a scenario for you. Okay, a single person living alone, furloughed, laid off, or fired because of the pandemic, no income. A small rainy day fund, maybe enough to cover 1 month's rent and utilities, but nothing beyond that. Doesn't have a sympathetic landlord. It's due when it's due. What can that person do right now?
Can I assume they're receiving unemployment through July through the Enhanced CARES Act?
Let's hope so.
Yeah, okay, so let's say they are. Obviously, this is what we call a group one, people that are greatly impacted. And so what's interesting about this time, Matt, is that in order to survive, you actually have to break a lot of personal finance rules. For 20 years, I've got these pillars of how you build a financial life. Well, once it starts to fall apart, the rules change. So that is to say, this person should really prioritize who gets paid, almost like a corporate bankruptcy of, well, I need food, and then I need shelter. You start to say, well, paying down my student loans or paying down my consumer debt is not even close to a priority. If you can, you try to maintain the debt by making minimum payments. I'd rather people take on more consumer debt than to wipe out their retirement funds. And that person should 100% understand the CARES Act, which allows them to defer student loan payments through October if they're federally backed student loans. And if they happen to own a home via a federally backed mortgage, like an FHA loan or a VA loan, They should take advantage of the 12 months worth of forbearance. But I'll tell you, what scares me the most about this situation is what happens in July. And I think this might be the thread of the rest of our conversation, because if you hear me talk to my friends or my colleagues or on my own show, I'm terrified for July, because I don't think the economy is going to be singing, and I think the support is going to run out. And I think it could be one of the stranger months in the history of our nation.
Hmm. And why is that? Just because the things are drying up and people are anticipating things coming back online, but they're not going to?
Yeah. And if the enhanced unemployment benefit has run out, which it is currently on pace to, despite the fact that the House of Representatives passed a bill that wanted to extend that into next year, which I'm not sure that would make it into the final bill that the president is going to sign. I think you're going to see this very weird, which will turn into a political struggle of, this person doesn't want to go back to work for what is, you know, being offered from a pay perspective, because they're so used to living on this enhanced unemployment benefit. And then the third weird angle to that is, will there actually be jobs there to offer the person to get them off of unemployment? I think that's why it's sticky. And I also think the Paycheck Protection Program for small businesses only throw fuel on this fire, because it's right around the middle to late part of June in which the 8 weeks of money for small businesses run out. And I have to tell you, anecdotally, I've already heard of a tremendous number of small businesses that plan to lay people off when the 8 weeks is over.
Mm. So for that group one person whose scenario we just heard, what are the lessons? What should they be sure to do in their future financial life?
Well, the thing is, you can't wait for it to get worse. And that's the lesson of all personal finance. Just because things aren't bad now doesn't mean they won't be really bad later. So if the person's comfortable with the $600 a month enhancement, they need to get as lean as they possibly can now and use that $600 a week, hopefully I said a week and not a month, that additional $600 a week through unemployment to create an emergency fund that can stretch them another 3 months post-July. I think, you know, the break glass in case of emergency scenario for that person is that they liquidate their retirement funds. But truly, Matt, that is the last thing you would do, because at that point you're fully sacrificing your future stability to save the now. And of course people do it because they think, well, what's it matter if I have a future if I don't have a now? And then you get into these sort of scenarios. But I think, frankly, going into consumer debt is a better idea than liquidating your retirement fund for that scenario you just gave me.
Mm, okay. Do you think that, I mean, does that seem to crop up as one of the most common problems in personal finance, just the lack of an emergency fund? Is that just a common thread in a lot of the scenarios that you are there to fix?
Yeah, it's because people struggle to, and I think you and I've actually had a version of this conversation before, people struggle to understand what is an emergency. You know, is this bad enough? Should I use it for this? And we get so comfortable. We find stability and comfort in our lifestyle and not actual financial stability. So someone will say, well, I'm comfortable, I'm fine, I'm stable. But what they're stable in, what they're comfortable in, is this lifestyle they created, not actual accumulated resources off to the side. And I think that's the most common financial, you know, wellness pitfall.
What is it, though, about an emergency fund that, I don't know, keeps cropping up as a problem? Why does it seem like it's so unattainable for so many people?
Well, I think it's very important to say it is a problem for two very distinct reasons. One, because the wage gap is still pretty ridiculous. I mean, we've got people not earning living wage, you know, not earning, you know, even to the poverty line. And so for those folks, and not to be dismissive of their struggle and what they're going through, it is virtually impossible to form an emergency fund if you're making below living wage. If not impossible, we can get rid of virtually. The other group of people really have fallen prey to an ever-increasing lifestyle. And I don't say this shouting it down the mountaintop, Matt. I'm not judging. I'm observing, because I see it at every income level. Again, goes back to, I have confidence in my ability to earn money. If I were to tighten it up, what I'm saying is I don't have confidence in my ability. And as silly and as armchair psychiatrist as that sounds, we see it every single day. And that is why people of all income levels, people making a couple $100,000 a year, households in Indianapolis making a couple $100,000 a year, are freaking out right now because they need the economy to flip back on so they can get back to what they do, which is be good at earning money, not good at handling money.
Mm. Okay, well, let's talk about the basics of an emergency fund, a rainy day fund. If someone doesn't have it yet, and I mean, of course, what we're talking about is just a decently funded savings account. Where should they start? How much should they shoot for to start with, and why?
The goal is 3 months, and I think that is what I consider to be a healthy emergency fund.
3 months of income or 3 months of expenses? What are we talking about?
That is the million-dollar question, because for a lot of households, their income is their expenses.
Yeah.
And so ideally, it's just expenses. But here's what I know from doing this for so long. It's your income, because most people don't have that much margin. So it's easy. If I make $5,000 a month of take-home pay, then I need $15,000 in an emergency fund. And what's wild about this, of course, you have to watch that it doesn't turn into a, you need an emergency fund, and you shout that at people when it's the least practical time to shout that at them. But I would argue now is the perfect time to get so lean. You and I are not spending like consumers like we were in January. If you look at your January bank statement in terms of the number of transactions and what you spent on a discretionary basis compared to April, it's like two different people, Matt. And so why not leverage that forced behavior change to begin to build an emergency fund? And I think that is what is possible for group two. You know, we talk about group one, they're not a foregone conclusion, but they're struggling, they're scrapping, they're trying to survive. Group two, get lean now. These are people that have not been greatly impacted yet, but don't have that emergency fund. So make a plan now as though you do lose 50% of your income and start to make those changes, because this thing is not over by any stretch of the imagination from a financial perspective. You know, I'm not even going to weigh in on the virus. I don't do that. But I'll tell you, from a financial perspective, we're not even close.
We are talking to Peter Dunn, Pete the Planner, about the lessons, the personal finance lessons of the COVID-19 pandemic. All right. So, Pete, here's another scenario. Let's throw in a few more variables than last time. In this one, we have dual earners with a higher combined household income, just above six figures. But the problem is they know it. So they've got a big mortgage, bigger than just one of them can handle by themselves. One loses their job because of the pandemic. A little bit of savings in the bank, but it's going to go quick. What is that couple learning right now?
Yeah, these are all sticky lessons, right? These are all brutal. But that's a very common one that we're seeing right now. For that couple, it is more likely that they are forced, and I'm using air quotes because you know how the medium of radio works. I'm using air quotes to say those people will likely dip into their retirement fund. Two jobs, the possibility and the likelihood of some retirement assets being there is pretty high. I think they would likely have that. If they have an FHA mortgage, they will likely seek mortgage relief. Again, 12 months worth of forbearance, which says you can put off your mortgage payment. It's a 180-day provision at first, and then you go back 6 months later to your lender and say, okay, here's the update, and they either give you another 180 days or you get back to paying your mortgage. But that person would likely seek relief via some of the CARES Act. Beyond that, then you get into some pretty nasty stuff, because the average couple that you just talked about, they also don't have an emergency fund. So that's why it gets so quickly into the retirement funds. But you usually would see that couple taking on quite a bit of debt in this scenario.
Do you think that digging into retirement should, I mean, you say that so many people might be digging into it, but do you think that should be an absolute last resort? And can it be even for the people who think it's their only option?
Here's the challenge with that. If you take money out of your 401k right now, which you can, the CARES Act would let you take $100,000 penalty free, you still owe taxes on that money within the next 3 years to the tune of 20%. So it's one of those, you know, permanent solutions to a temporary problem that then becomes another problem down the road. I tend to think all of us, as this relates to all of us, our biggest challenge in life financially is retirement. And most people don't think that. They think of these little, you know, they think of times like this. This will be the biggest challenge they ever have. That's actually not true. The biggest challenge you will ever have is shutting off your income for decades and surviving on what you made during your work career. And so that's why I think it's the last ditch effort, because if you think now is a big problem, try having no money with no ability to work when you're in your 60s or 70s. And I'm not being, you know, flippant about that. I've just seen it so many times when people didn't have a feasible strategy to retire. And we haven't even talked about the solvency of Social Security and the impact our time now will have on that program in people's retirements.
Mm. Have you heard the argument, and it's not a popular one right now, and it's not one that anyone's bringing up for a lot of reasons, but have you heard the argument that too many people having too much money in savings will ultimately be not great for the economy? And what's your response to that argument?
I think about that all the time.
Yeah.
I really do. And I think our personal economies is more important than the global economy. And what's weird about saying that is I'm saying save money, but in saving money, you're going to hurt the global economy, which theoretically would then hurt your personal economy. But I don't think a person can get through this without securing their own stability. They can't operate on a wing and a prayer that if we all spray money at the economy at the same time, it'll kill the monster and we'll be fine. It doesn't work that way. Mm. I'll tell you, I have stability. I have found so much comfort in the last 60 days of saving more money than ever before, not out of greed, not out of fear, but of comfort. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that.
How many people do you think have never felt that? That have never felt the comfort of putting a little bit away and tucking it away so that you may never use it again until you absolutely need to? Is that a comfort that a lot of people know?
This might not be the answer you expect, but I think a lot of people have gotten a taste of that. It's a great feeling. I had it for the first time when I was a teenager. You see money accumulate from one month to the next with no intention of spending that money. It can be addictive. And we're a little off track to how do we fix this, but I'll say people feeling stable is a big part of this. I wrote about it in my Indianapolis Business Journal column this past week. Self-sufficiency will be the byproduct of this time. People will kick convenience to the side and reevaluate the relationship with time and money. When they have more time, they will spend less money. And when they have more money, they may save their time too, right? I think we have a weird relationship with convenience, and I've felt that way for a couple of years.
All right. So we've talked a little bit about retirement. Let's do another scenario here. This one dealing with retirement. I really wish that we could take people's individual scenarios on the air, but we are pre-taped today. So maybe we can do something like this another time, but here we are. Okay. Dual earners. Kids are out of the house. House is paid for. They thought retirement was just a year or two away, but they've seen their retirement accounts lose a lot since the market fell. What should that couple be thinking about?
You know, it's strange that I'm the least concerned about this group, not because I'm dismissive of their concerns, but I feel like that they've got the best scenario you've just said.
Yeah.
Unless you've written a nasty letter to your boss with four-letter words saying you're quitting on a specific day 2 years from now, that ship has not sailed. And by the way, I don't think the market is a long-term concern. I think it's reasonable, as long as that person didn't panic mid-March of 2020, that their retirement may end up being exactly what they want. And to boot, they may have gotten lean. They may have begun to live closer to the vest. And if that is the case, they've made their retirement easier by getting leaner prior to the retirement income kicking in. Too often, retirees wait until they retire to start minding their spending. Minding it 2 years before you retire is guaranteeing success because you practice living on that income level.
Well, let me add another variable to that. Say they've already retired and that retirement account has fallen so much. Maybe they hit their goal before retirement, but now that it's so far from their goal, would you give me the same answer?
No, because then you've just hit the other end of my spectrum, which that is the scariest thing. And again, if you've just retired and you're listening, settle down. Let's talk through this because you got to talk. You need to talk to your investment advisor about this. But Matt, this is called sequence of return risk. It is one of the scariest thing that can happen to you from an investment perspective. When investment advisors map out your financial future in retirement, they have to assume that you're going to get different rates of return through the years. The ugliest scenario is in the first year you retire, you take a massive double-digit hit because then it affects payout years forever, right? And so the remedy is if your financial advisor had set cash, not physical cash, but, you know, cash holdings to the side to fund 2 years in case sequence of return risk became the problem. In other words, if your advisor knows what they're doing, you're living off of cash right now and not pulling out of the market until the market recovers, and then you'll resume getting your income from market instruments. It really separates the good advisors from the bad right now, and these are some of the worst stories that I'm hearing along with my peers.
There's more to talk about with Peter Dunn, Pete the Planner. Up next, we will talk more about what people can do to prevent financial turmoil like the kind this pandemic has wrought. I'm Matt Pelser. We're back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. We're back with personal finance expert and fellow Hoosier Pete the Planner talking about the financial lessons, the personal finance lessons of the pandemic. And Pete, do you see people's habits changing because of this on the grand scheme? I mean, I've heard it said that a lot of people who lived through the Depression are better savers. They're penny pinchers. The lessons of that time really echoed through those people's lives. But that has also... it also came at a very different time culturally. And now today's younger people and adults have lived through both the Great Recession and now this pandemic. I guess, first of all, the first of those two parts, was the Great Recession enough of a wake up call for people, do you think?
No.
No?
It wasn't. I feel like it was a minor reset. And I think the proof of that is how lending has almost gone exactly back to pre-recession levels from that time frame. You look at banking practices and people's debt-to-income ratio, and you look at even new car buying and how those habits have gotten back to where they were before the Great Recession. And so I think we hit a little bit of a reset button, but it was not life-changing at all for the younger generations.
So is the pandemic going to be the one, do you think, to put it over the top, to make us to really drive home those lessons?
Is it gross to say I hope so? I mean, because I don't like to be glib, but I think we look at our great grandparents and our grandparents and anyone who experienced the Depression, the Great Depression, or were children of the Depression, and we look at their stories as quaint and antiquated, that's for sure. But we say, well, things are different now. I mean, now there's more consumer credit flowing. You know, what it is to be impoverished then versus now is different. And so we say, well, those times are different. Matt, to some degree, I hope we all adopt this level of sensibility that came with the Depression. And that's not a negative thing. I think it's a positive thing of being more resourceful, being more self-sufficient, valuing stability over lifestyle. I don't hold out a tremendous amount of hope for that, but that is my hope. And I think if we ever have had a chance in our lifetime for that to happen, it certainly is now.
Do you think it's going to take a cultural shift, though, for that to really cement itself? I mean, like I said, the time of the Depression is so different from the time now, culturally. It just seems like so much is going to need to become more acceptable to people, I guess.
Yes, it will have to absolutely be a cultural shift. I think there would theoretically have to be policy to, you know, tighten the wage gap and to deal with people who are not covered via insurance. You know, there was the meme going around when this all began of, you know, your grandfather was asked to go to war and we're asked to stay inside for 2 months. And, you know, we all had a little bit of a chuckle to that. But, you know, there are harsher realities to that dynamic than just staying inside. Our economy is shut off. Small businesses are going under. But I do think there would have to be a political and cultural shift for these lessons of this economic pandemic to stick long term.
But with things being as politically polarized as they are right now, do you think that that's even a conversation that we can have, or is the pandemic kind of forcing us into that position?
Well, I have to say, out of fairness, I'm always the person that's willing to have these types of conversations on any topic at any time. Like, I'm not a, this is not the time for that conversation. I think you have them. And I think we're having that conversation on a pretty big scale. Think of some of the programs that are part of the stimulus package, the CARES Act, that have merely just been talked about on the campaign trail for the last 12 years or so. But now all of these things that we were told were not possible are possible. If that is not moving the needle, I don't know what is.
How common is it for people to be too proud to ask for financial advice?
You know, it's not really fair to evaluate an interviewer's questions as that's a good question and that's a bad question. But that's the that is the best question of the day. And it is actually my favorite question. The reason that our wage gap is the way it is, to some level, to my opinion here, is that too often the narrative of, well, you can pull yourself up by the bootstraps. And I am a huge fan of personal responsibility. I grew up in Speedway, Indiana, the home of personal responsibility, a proud Midwesterner. But man, now is the time to ask for help. Now is the time to accept help. I think proud people, and I don't mean that as a pejorative, struggle to accept help when they should. And that's what slays me with this entire situation, is some restaurants from the very beginning, some local restaurants shut it down immediately so they could positively take advantage of the system for their people, right? Others tried to make it work, and others simply didn't shut down because they were too proud not to. And that ends up hurting everyone. I want people to get the help they need. I always get upset when someone doesn't know what to do and they refuse to say, I don't know what to do. I think there's strength in vulnerability. I think there's strength in knowing your intellectual and financial limits of knowledge. And I sure as heck hope, I'm still a Midwesterner, I sure as heck hope that we accept help. And unfortunately, that's a political statement too. And that's what is disheartening more than anything with this whole thing, is I wish everything wasn't a political issue. I wish that personal responsibility and accepting help wasn't a political issue, but it certainly feels like it is these days.
I don't want you to play crystal ball or anything, but what, I mean, you've mentioned twice now how wide the wage gap is. I mean, what would it realistically take to close that without there being some big political strife and a big reworking of the financial system?
Man, I don't know. I just don't. I mean, I just told you in the previous question, you got to say when you don't know. But I'll say this. The weird thing is, and this is going to get me some emails and tweets from your show, I'm not the anti-billionaire guy, right? Like, I know, like, a lot of people like to take this issue, and it's fine. It's their opinion. And it's just my opinion that there can be millionaires and there can be a tightened wage gap. They're not mutually exclusive. Lots of people disagree with that. But I happen to think that that is not necessarily the issue. But a lot smarter people, people with actual data, disagree with me.
Well, okay, but that's a catharsis, isn't it? Like so much of our political lives these days. I mean, it's just people popping off. And so, but the problem is the wage gap evolved over time, you know, and it can't be corrected overnight. It has to be corrected over a span of time. Do you think it can be done over a span of time that was shorter than it took for us to get to this point? Or will it have to?
It'll have to, yeah. You know, whether there's a national $15 minimum wage or something like that. I think you're going to have to see some wage growth, some structured wage growth at the lowest levels. But again, there's two major, very different problems at work here. The wage gap, which gives that portion of the population zero chance. And then there's the people on the other side who have the income, but are making behavioral issues that sabotage themselves from a personal finance standpoint.
We are talking with Pete the Planner, Peter Dunn, a personal finance expert from Indiana, and we are talking about the lessons of the pandemic on our personal finance goals. So let's try another scenario here. A couple with kids, let's say three younger kids, elementary school age. They have a middle income household. They can handle the mortgage with just one of them working, but not if both of them lose their jobs. Well, in this scenario, they've both lost their income. Pretty common these days. But they haven't lost their jobs. They may be going back to their jobs when this is all over. Savings is going quick. No idea when either of them will be back to work, though. What should that couple be figuring out?
This situation is very common, as you said, and what's disconcerting about it is there's so many plates spinning, you don't know which ones to try to catch.
Yeah.
You know, the kids are what make this difficult. That's not to say it's easier without kids, but it is easier without kids because you start thinking, well, I've been their e-teacher for 3 months. You start thinking, I need to fund their college education. They need to get back to youth sports. And it just distracts you from the primary issue, which is if we're currently on unemployment, what are we going to do in July when that unemployment period ends? If you don't know when your job's coming back, at least you can plan to the end of July when you know that your unemployment benefit is going away. Because at that point in time, you can then tap your retirement reserves if you have to. You can go into consumer debt via a home equity loan, or you can draw a cash advance on credit cards. Again, things that I would normally, turn the radio off if I heard someone say, because they're ridiculous. But that is the times we're in. I think that's what a person would have to do. I think the likely scenario what that couple would do would be something I still would not encourage them to do, which is to borrow from family member or friends. I think more people will continue to turn to that, which I think isn't even an option. I don't even call it the last option. I don't think it is a reasonable option whatsoever, because a person who helps someone who is struggling generally does it under the guise of, well, I'm in a relatively better position than you, but they aren't necessarily in a good position, which can take both entities down.
And then that can really strain a personal relationship moving forward. Is that kind of the top of the rock reason?
It is under normal times. I think under these times, you are talking about two separate households becoming destitute over time if things are really that bad. I like to, this is oversimplification of what I'm about to say, but I like to think if a lending institution who is in the business of lending money won't lend someone money, then someone who is not in the business of lending money should lend someone money. I mean, that's pretty cut and dry. And then even if you remove the word lend and say you say the word gift, it still creates a lot of headaches for both people.
Mm. All right, let's get back to some basics here. So it seems like one of the easiest ways to manage your money is to get ahead of it, is just to know your limits before you saddle yourself with a bigger purchase, like one you'll pay for over years, a car, a house. I mean, that's easy for me to say, but I mean, does it really get more complicated than that?
It's complicated in execution. It's simple in idea. And it's really about household standards. It's about refusing to make a purchase that takes away from the goal at hand. If the goal at hand in the next 12 calendar months is to secure 3 months worth of expenses / income, then every decision has to revolve around that. You have to set your grocery budget. You have to set you're not going on vacation. You have to set your holiday spending. You have to set everything around that. Your movie packages on your television, your internet speed, all decisions have to revolve around that personal standard. I think the last time I was on your show, we talked about personal standards from the sake of a vegetarian doesn't deny bacon every time they eat. They've already made that decision. That is their standard. They don't have to re-decide it. So everything else is secondary to that. And that's how people begin to rebuild and create stability, is that they take their personal standards seriously and stop forcing themselves to re-decide every time they make a purchase.
Well, let's look at the biggest purchase that a person can make, the house. What is your rule for how much house someone can realistically afford?
I like this because the guffaws will actually, you know, be all over Indianapolis right now, because 25% of take home pay is what I like, and close to no one does that. And the reason close to no one does that is because you don't have to do that. Banks encourage you to spend a lot more than that, but that is also the exact same reason people don't have 3 months' expenses saved. Now look, if you have 3 months' expenses saved and you want to be at 30, 32, 33% of your take-home pay, you've earned the right to do that with your stability. But if you start out without stability and you push the limits of housing affordability, you will never get to stability. I have to argue, this is why the rich get richer. That old axiom that is not fun to say or hear. It's because the people with stability are in a better position to better their lives. And the people that do not either value stability or have never had a chance to because of an income gap can never get there.
Okay, what about, though, the kind of mortgage that you get, that you can get? If anything, the Great Recession simplified that list a little bit, because it used to be full of options that, frankly, were not that great. But now it's a little safer. As you said before, some of those bad loans are coming back. But which mortgages are the better choices for someone who has yet to buy a house?
Well, I mean, a lot of people will end up with federally backed mortgages if it's their first purchase, you know, an FHA loan or something like that. But generally, a 15-year fixed or a 30-year fixed are what you want to look at. I do have to say, though, for a renter right now who has a down payment ready to go and who has stable income and an emergency fund on top of a down payment, I don't know if there's ever been a better time to be a home buyer. I also have to admit, I'm frankly shocked that the housing market is hanging on as much as it is. It's taken a hit, but I thought it would get crushed, and it's still kind of hanging on. I thought this would flip into being a buyer's market because it's been a seller's market for years, but I don't know if the last sentence has been written on that story quite yet.
Indeed. So last time we talked to you for just a segment, and we talked to you about the new service that you've launched called Hey Money. First, let's just explain what Hey Money is very quickly.
It's essentially professional financial problem solving. All the scenarios you just ran through today, for about $20 a month, you're matched with a financial expert who just begins to solve these issues. It's not exactly financial planning. It is financial problem solving. It has very little to do with investments and more to do with the decisions we have to make.
And so how can Hey Money, or could Hey Money, help people right now in about 30 seconds?
Yeah, well, it's interesting because this feels like we're a ship taken on water and we're in the bucket business. We love tough situations and we love to guide people through them. So you can go to callheymoney.com if you're interested.
All right. Well, we've been talking about the personal finance lessons that can be learned from the pandemic with Indiana's own Pete the Planner. Pete, thanks as always.
Thanks, Matt.
And you can find more of him, including his weekly podcast, at PeteThePlanner.com. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Maggie Galon. Scott Cameron's our managing editor. Adam Gross is our technical director. Our podcast can be found wherever you get podcasts. Be sure to subscribe so you always know what we're talking about. We are on Twitter and Facebook at All in Indiana, and I'm Matt Pelser. Thanks for listening. This is All In.